This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, in his State of the State address, Governor Peter Shumlin made a bold request to the legislature. He asked lawmakers to think about the effects of global climate change and to send him a divestiture bill, modeled on one passed in 2015 by California, that would divest the state's pension funds from companies that engage in coal mining operations.
I don't need to remind you that Vermont is downwind of the coal-fired plants to our west. We're the tailpipe to their dirty energy choices. Their pollution sickens our children, creates acid rain, dumps mercury on our forests and in our lakes, and increases greenhouse gas emissions.
The governor also called on the legislature specifically to rid state holdings of any and all ExxonMobil stock.
It has been clearly documented since the 1980s that ExxonMobil's own scientists have long known about the dangers of global warming and chose to conceal it from the public. At the same time that they were building their oil rigs taller to account for rising sea levels, they were funding front groups of scientists to deny that climate change is real.
But how would that actually work? As state treasurer, Beth Pierce is in charge of Vermont's pension plans. On Monday, I spoke with her about her thoughts on the governor's proposal, and I asked her when she first learned of the governor's plan.
Well, the governor and I talked about 10:30 that day, and he informed me at that time the direction he was heading in, and heard it at the State of the State, but he did make me aware of it just prior to.
That's not much of a heads up.
Well, I appreciated the heads up. I think that we both clearly are concerned about the environment. We want to work together. He has been a partner. This is a particular issue where we do have some disagreement. I'm looking forward to working with him and the legislature to find alternatives that can get us to the same area without doing divestment.
Governor Shumlin referenced California legislation passed in 2015 that would mandate that state's two largest state pension plans to divest from coal holdings by 2017. Currently, those plans, which are worth nearly $500 billion, have only 1% of the funds invested in coal assets. How much of Vermont's assets are invested in coal?
Well, we have about $1 million if you use the global industry code. The definition that's used in the California legislation is fairly limited, where 50% or more of the revenues are from coal mining. So there's different ways to measure this, but roughly about $1 million for coal.
Do you have a sense of what percentage $1 million is?
Well, we're at about just under $4 billion of assets.
Okay, so it's a fairly small amount then that could be classified as coal holdings.
That is correct.
The governor is also pushing for divesting from oil holdings, pending a California review that would look at how much this would cost that state. You've looked at that for Vermont when this issue has been raised by environmental advocates in the past. How much would the state funds lose in returns if they were divested from all fossil fuel holdings?
Well, we've done an analysis in 2013, 2014, and 2015 on this, and we used our in-house resources, which is our director of investments, plus an outside source, NEPC LLC out of Boston. They don't do investments themselves, so they have no skin in the game. In other words, they're not talking to their books, so to speak, and their job is to act as a fiduciary. Between their analyses and our analyses, we estimate that if we were to go to fossil fuel divestment, we would have costs up to about $9 million per year, plus beginning transaction costs at the front end, but $9 million of annual losses to the system.
And if it were just coal, presumably that's a much lower number, but still a loss?
It's still a loss. And part of the reason is it's a little like an analogy I would make to doing your books. Whether you do $100,000, $1 million, or $100 million in accounting, you still have to do the debits and credits. I'm an accounting finance person. I had to use that for my analogy. But the bottom line is that unlike CalPERS, which CalPERS is $300 million, just past the $300 million mark.
That's the California pension plan.
The California state plan, and then there's CalSTRS, the teacher plan. They have over 2,000 staff. They do direct investments. They have specialists in various areas. We have, as I say, just under a $4 billion fund. We manage through managers. We make an asset allocation, and then we try to select best-in-class managers within those asset groups. we don't pick our day-to-day investments. So we're not in a position where we could turn around to a manager and say, you have to exclude this from your portfolio. Now, there are two types of funds that we do. One is separated funds, segregated funds. And in that case, we would end up having to require the manager to put screens in to exclude certain investments at certain GIC classes, for instance. That costs money. Also, the manager could say that's not something we're prepared to do and you need to look elsewhere to invest your funds. The bigger issue are commingled funds, where we don't own the assets per se, but we are share similar to a mutual fund, and we'd have those in a number of asset classes. And in those cases, we would be unable to direct the investment manager to divest of those funds and would have to look for other funds, likely at a higher cost to the system.
But doesn't the state already provide a fund? It was opened in 2014, I believe, or opened up in 2014 for state workers who want to voluntarily choose a pension fund that's completely divested from fossil fuel-based companies.
That is a mutual fund we did on my advice to the Teachers Municipal and the State Board. We asked them to consider putting in an optional fund within the fund groupings for the deferred compensation program. So these are optional retirement services where someone may want to supplement the money that they would receive in retirement from their defined benefit program. In those, usually you have a fund lineup, and an individual may choose from that fund lineup, whether it's stocks, bonds, different types. And we have a socially responsible investment mix within those fund lineups. We added, at my recommendation, the PAX Global Fund that is a fossil fuel-free mutual fund. To date, about 690,000 has been invested by 334 participants since we opened this in 2014.
But why couldn't you just do that for the entire state pension plan?
Well, again, the pension plan is managed with a series of asset allocations to specific asset classes. Some of those are commingled vehicles. Some of them are less liquid than others. It's not a case where we can put a system in place without adding additional costs to the defined benefit plan. In the case of the mutual fund, if someone so chooses, they may do so.
Treasurer Pierce, in his State of the State address, Governor Shumlin also specifically called out ExxonMobil, saying, quote, owning ExxonMobil stock is not a business Vermont should be in. The way you described how our pension funds are managed suggests that it would be difficult, I'm not sure even whether it sounds like it's possible, for us to excise one specific company from our stock portfolio.
I think it would be difficult. I'd have to take a look at the specifics of it, but I do believe it would be difficult. It certainly would add cost to the system. And it also sets a dangerous precedent. When you start to legislate what you're going to invest in, I think that's a situation where you could end up with other stocks and other issues going down the road. I think the term slippery slope does apply there. And it's likely to have an adverse impact on the fund.
But climate activists from 350.org and other groups that have pushed for divestment say the state, this state, some other states, are trying to fight global warming on the one hand, but then investing stock in companies that, you know, as I said, Governor Shumlin calling out ExxonMobil in particular as a company that he says chose to conceal the dangers of global warming from the public. So it seems like in terms of a moral choice, the state is operating sort of on two sides of the coin from that perspective.
There's an option that's there that hasn't been discussed, which is standing toe-to-toe with the folks at ExxonMobil at their annual meeting and discussing the issues of climate change and to work with them on or at least get across the arguments around the need for a more robust investment in renewable energy, for instance. I went to the ExxonMobil meeting last year and was able to articulate that I thought their approach to renewables was wholly inadequate. Were we successful? No. We did have success across the Atlantic on the other side with BP and getting some initiatives done there that moved to a better carbon disclosure on the part of BP. So there are steps that we can take. I also want to work with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In 2007, Vermont petitioned along with probably 20-some-odd other investors petitioned the SEC to develop rules for environmental disclosure. 2010, the SEC promulgated those rules. And we would like to work with the SEC to see if there are ways that we can get more compliance from companies, oil and gas companies, around their their climate change issues and the environmental impacts of their business. And we think that these are ways as investors that we can do this. The big issue is that when you give up your shares, it's not that the company will have less, because they're going to turn around. Someone's going to turn around and buy those shares. And it might be someone who has a less interest in environment than Vermont. And that, I think, is disadvantageous. I think that companies should hear from their investors the issues of climate change. I'm on a group called the Carbon Asset Risk Group. We're engaged with 20-some-odd companies around the stranded asset thesis, the fact that they've already have enough reserves in oil and gas, and why are we doing research and expending capital dollars as investors? Why are you, this company spending those dollars to do more when we can't use the reserves that we currently have? So those are things you can do as an investor. And for me, we are advocates. Vermont and the Treasurer's Office was a founding member of the Investment Network for Climate Risk. I'm going to be down in New York at the UN for Investor Climate Risk Conference, where Vermont is a convener at the end of this month. We are actively engaged in working with these companies and working with our investment managers. That's the other side of the coin that gets lost on occasion. We are actively talking to our investment managers. How do you value, how do you consider carbon asset risk? How do you consider the stranded asset thesis? Where do you see climate change, and how does that impact your investments? A good number of our investment managers are signatories to the UN Principles for Responsible Investments. So we are trying to do the right thing by working with companies, working with our investment managers, but at the same time preserving the retirement security for the 48,000, actually it's closer to 49,000 active, vested, and retired members of our system. As a trustee of those systems, as a fiduciary to those systems, I have an obligation to those individuals to preserve those retirement funds. It's a trust that's important. It's a promise that has been made to those individuals. And as I said before, I believe in Vermont, our promises are golden, and we have a responsibility to those members.
Well, so it sounds pretty clear that your position has not changed, that you want to push for change from the inside, but you don't support divestment. But can you clarify, are you, as state treasurer, even allowed to make a move like that would lose the state workers millions of dollars in returns each year? I mean, is your fiduciary responsibility, does it give you the flexibility to do that?
Well, I think there's some arguments that can be made on that. And I think rather than getting there, first I want to work with the legislature on looking at alternatives to investments. Let's work with the SEC. There are good people there that we can work with and make some change. Let's work with our investment managers. Let's move forward on things that we can work together with the governor, with the legislature, and the citizens of Vermont, the advocacy groups, to find partnerships where we can do better. I want to concentrate on that, not, you know, what's the next step when we do it. I want to go forward with a plan that I think works and preserves retirement security at the same time. The taxpayers have skin in the game on this. They are contributing to this either through their taxes or in municipalities. And the stakeholders in the system, the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, the retired associations, the Vermont State Employees Association, and the NEA have all said in specific resolutions, which I will be submitting to the legislature, don't legislate investments. Leave that with the VPIC. Leave that with the Vermont Pension Investment Committee.
But it seems like it would be pretty important to know, as the legislature moves forward with this directive from the governor, whether or not you are even allowed to do what could be asked of you. And I'm not clear from your response whether you know if that's something that you'd be able to do in your position.
How it is written, there have been challenges in the past to divestment activities in other states. I really don't want to go there. What I really want to do is look at ways that we can move forward together. Vermonters can disagree on issues, but we ultimately work together to find solutions.
That's State Treasurer Beth Pierce. Treasurer Pierce, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Coming up, the tumultuous, brilliant life of Ludwig van Beethoven. VPR Classical's James Stewart joins us. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. The history of Western art and music is full of names we know, but sometimes we don't know as much about those people as we ought to. Our colleagues at VPR Classical are passionate about bridging that knowledge gap and sharing the events, characters, and concepts that shaped our Western musical tradition. Today, classical host James Stewart illuminates one figure who's central to classical music, Ludwig van Beethoven.
Ludwig van Beethoven has been called the most admired composer in all of music history. His legacy stands as a monument for the entire 19th century and beyond. Beethoven was named after his grandfather, the Kapellmeister for the court of the Electorate of Cologne in Bonn, Germany. This elder Ludwig was a talented musician and vocalist, but Beethoven's father, Johann, was less so. The younger Ludwig inherited more than just a name from his grandfather. His talents began to blossom at an early age. The composer Christian Gottlieb Neefer took a 9-year-old Beethoven under his wing as his pupil, and it wasn't long before Beethoven was being compared with another young prodigy, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Beethoven spent his teenage years employed as a musician and composer at the court in Bonn until an opportunity arose for him to travel to Vienna and study with Franz Joseph Haydn. The trip was made possible by the support of Count von Waldstein, an early patron of Beethoven's. Waldstein declared that with the help of hard work, Beethoven would receive Mozart's spirit from Haydn's hands. Sadly, Beethoven found it difficult to trust Haydn. His early diaries hold some harsh words for the older composer. As their relationship fell apart, Beethoven found further instruction with the composers Albrechtsberger and Antonio Salieri. Beethoven caught on quickly as a pianist and composer in Vienna. He was extremely talented and also very socially connected, thanks to his work and reputation in Bonn. Beethoven waited till just the right moment to publish his first opus, a set of piano trios. This work was pre-sold to subscribers, showing that the young composer was also a savvy businessman. As the 18th century was coming to a close, Beethoven was looking to appeal to a broader audience, so he embarked on his first tour in 1796. While traveling, he wrote this letter to his brother Johann, saying, "I am well, very well. My art is winning me friends and respect, and what more do I want? And this time, I shall make a good deal of money." Indeed, Beethoven's reputation in Vienna and across Europe only grew as the years continued. However, in 1801, Beethoven wrote another letter, this time to an old friend in Bonn, expressing a secret that he had been holding in for several years. At the age of 30, the great Beethoven was losing his hearing. At the dawning of the 19th century, Beethoven had not given up hope that his doctors would find a treatment to reverse his hearing loss. His condition was not only affecting his musical output, but also his social life, which was very important to him. His letters take a dark turn at this point, but in spite of his melancholy, Beethoven's career was actually taking off. Multiple publishers would bid for each new work that he composed. He had also found a new love, the Countess Giulietta Giusciardi, who was only 17. Beethoven was absolutely smitten, but lamented that he was not of her social class. She married the Count Gallenberg, another composer. In response to this heartbreak, Beethoven wrote his Heiligenstadt Testament, declaring the depths of his despair. Yet in 1803, his mood seemed to lighten. Determined to not let his deafness hinder his career, Beethoven composed a flurry of new works, including his third symphony, the Eroica, the original title of which was Bonaparte. Beethoven idealized Napoleon. That is, until he had the audacity to declare himself emperor. Beethoven was so angered by this that he tore the title page of his symphony in two and stated that the work was composed to celebrate the memory of a great man. Beethoven fell in love again with the widow Josephine von Brunswick. Their relationship is documented in his letters to her, and it seems that social concerns again made marriage impossible. It's no wonder that his first and only opera is a testament to the virtuous wife and married love. The premiere of this opera, Leonora, or Fidelio, was doomed by the invasion of Vienna by Napoleon's forces in 1805. The next few years were a time of great creativity for Beethoven. However, he was growing nervous. Though his fame was increasing, his income was sporadic. Beethoven was reminded of Mozart's fate just 15 years before. At this time, he was offered an appointment as Kapellmeister for Napoleon's younger brother, Jerome. Beethoven used this offer to leverage the aristocracy of Vienna. If they wished to keep Beethoven in their city, then it was time to pay. Three noblemen stepped up as patrons, ensuring that Beethoven would be financially supported and remain in Vienna. Beethoven fell in love yet again, this time with Therese Malfatti. When he proposed marriage in 1810 at the age of 40, the 18-year-old turned him down. A couple of years later, Beethoven's own brother, Johann, became enamored with Therese and took her as his mistress and later his wife. This marked a period of deep depression that limited Beethoven's creative output for the next few years. The years 1813 to 1816 were a dry period for Beethoven. He was wrestling with his health and with his family. His brother Caspar had passed away and left behind a son, Karl, Beethoven's beloved nephew. Ludwig entered into a nasty custody battle with Karl's mother and lost. Beethoven often wrote in his journal prayers that this time of suffering would come to an end. An answer seemed to come in the fall of 1817. Even though Beethoven was now forced to carry on conversations with pen and paper due to his deafness, he embarked on some of the largest and most celebrated works of his entire catalog. These works include his Hammerklavier Sonata, Opus 106, and his Missa Solemnis, which was written for the Archduke, now Archbishop, Rudolf. But the ultimate expression of this last period of Beethoven's output has to be his Ninth Symphony. He had been thinking about this work ever since he left Bonn. In a letter dating back to 1793, he expressed his desire to create a choral setting of Schiller's Ode to Joy. He even sketched out a few ideas in 1812, just before his dry period. But 1823 was the year. Beethoven devoted himself to writing this choral symphony, marrying voices and orchestra in a new, unique way. At the premiere, Beethoven couldn't hear the audience's applause, but he could see their standing ovation as they waved hats and handkerchiefs in the air for their beloved composer. The last 3 years of Beethoven's life were devoted almost completely to the composition of string quartets, a genre pioneered by his teacher, Papa Haydn. At the time, Beethoven hadn't written a string quartet for close to 15 years. And though they were all but ignored by his contemporaries, these six late quartets became inspirations to numerous composers who followed after Beethoven. Stravinsky declared that these works would be contemporary forever. 1827 began with Beethoven's health in severe decline. However, it also saw a great outpouring of support as societies from multiple nations sent the dying composer gifts, letters, and financial aid. Beethoven passed away at 5:45 p.m. on March the 26th. His funeral, 3 days later, was attended by 10,000 mourners. His legacy, though, lives on.
That's VPR Classical's James Stewart walking us through the brilliant and tumultuous life of Ludwig van Beethoven. That story is part of the series Timeline, which is made possible in part by a grant from the Ida and William Rosenthal Foundation. Just ahead, the Montshire Museum of Science celebrates its 40th year in the Upper Valley. We'll learn how the museum feeds the scientific curiosity of young and old alike. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. This past weekend, the Montshire Museum of Science on the banks of the Connecticut River in Norwich celebrated its 40th birthday with a big celebration. But it's just the first in a year of birthday events and big exhibits. This milestone comes as new executive director Marcos Staffney works to build on the work of David Gowdy, who retired from that position after 35 years with the museum. Staffney comes to the Montshire from the Brooklyn Children's Museum and is still exploring his new home and environment. I visited the Montshire on New Year's Day to explore what's happening at this science and environmental hub in the Upper Valley, and I got a tour from Staffney.
We're on our mezzanine, and you get a great look down at some of our really great classic exhibitions like Sea of Clouds, which is this wonderful art piece by Ned Kahn that just gets people to really think about mist and clouds, which is something I think people in Vermont have to think a lot about when they wake up in the morning or they travel over the Connecticut River. And it gives an opportunity for kids to just sort of experiment. Well, what happens if I blow on a cloud? What happens if I walk past it? What happens if I put my hands inside of it? Can I put my hands inside of it? What is this makeup? What is this whole like material, this substance? And it, I think, adds nicely to like other experiences that you see below here, like all of these visitors working with our bubbles. So as you can see, there's an awesome redhead kid over there.
Maybe about three or four, you think?
Yeah, and he's just blowing bubbles, and he's just popping them, and he's saying, wait a second, that bubble can fly, that bubble can go back in the liquid, I can blow on this bubble, I can touch this bubble, I can really experience bubbleness, but what is it even? Like, and he doesn't quite know what it is yet. He's just experimenting with the world around him.
So he's experimenting with these bubbles, just playing in this kind of exciting, visceral environment for him. For older kids in the bubble exhibit, do they get to figure out exactly what a bubble is and how it works?
They do. They get to test their limits out with what they understand a bubble is. And in the exhibition, there are scaffolded ways of learning more information about how do we make our bubble solution. So it's not just that we throw some soap into some water and all of a sudden you've got bubbles. And now you can do that at home, and kids have been doing that when they wash dishes all the time. In our exhibition, you see not just that bubbles are beautiful and fun to play with, but that architects use bubbles, mathematicians use bubbles. There's a really amazing buildings that are bubble shaped, and the way that the architects have been able to design those buildings is by experimenting with bubble shape and seeing how can air fill up an inflatable or a bubble-like structure. So kids can start to see the connections around them that sometimes even the simplest science can be manifested in like really magnificent ways out there in the world.
I can remember as a child going to the awesome Science Children's Museum in San Francisco and playing with bubbles. And as we were walking up here to this second level to look down on this exhibit, you said, you know, bubble exhibits are nothing new for children's museums, partly because they're so cool. But yours is a little bit different because you've tried to think really carefully about what kinds of people might want to access this exhibit and how everybody can. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've made it accessible?
Sure. Our designers really worked hard in actually surveying the whole field of bubble exhibitions within the country, which is hard to do. You have to trust that when you send them out that they're going to come back with some really great information. And they also surveyed and worked with lots of community members about, well, what's going to work in the best way, and also how can we make it as accessible as possible, both with content, you know, we want to think about, you know, we want people to feel comfortable learning about bubbles, but also with the physicality of the exhibition. So in our contemporary practice of exhibition design, we're really thinking about accessibility from multiple angles. It's not just we must make it wheelchair accessible. It's, well, what if someone has weak grip strength? Or what if someone really benefits from sensory experiences? We have this amazing foam exhibition downstairs where there are three different types of foam that are pumping out of these tubes. And just sometimes having kids be able to explore with their senses, having them experience foam, having them be able to touch that in a way that they can feel difference and feel textures and feel the difference between smooth and rough, that is something that we want to be sure that we're accessible to all folks of all ages, of all abilities.
Show me one of the other exhibits that you really like here.
That I really like? Oh my gosh.
I know there are, what, 140 exhibits?
That's the worst question ever. We're looking right next to the spinning table is something that we call Skittles. This is a wind-up toy. I don't know how to quite explain it. Like, it's like a top, and so you wind up the top with a piece of twine, and then you let it loose, and we have three different platforms that top can go down. And what I always find interesting is the minute you teach an adult how to, like, wind the top and let it roll, the adults think it very competitive about seeing how long their tops can stay spinning, which platform that they launch it off of it will have the best effect. I brought some of my friends who are my age here, and I said, okay, make sure you see this, the ants, go outside. You only have an hour and a half. I've got to stay working and explore the whole museum. Came back 30 minutes later, they were still at the Skittles table playing because they really were just enjoying it and they wanted to like master it. And I think that's kind of the fun thing about our exhibitions here is that you can keep coming back to them over and over again And it really does require you. It requires you to participate with it to make the whole experience complete. You know, it's not just content on a wall that could be read or, you know, sort of exists as research. It's the whole experience here requires you plus the exhibition.
You know, mentioning the adults playing Skittles, when you took over in March, you said one of the things that you really wanted to focus on was looking at adult education at the museum in addition to children's education, and in addition to children's learning and entertainment. So is that what you mean, just maybe competitive Skittles playing in the evenings?
I think it's about how do you communicate to folks that the objects and things and experiences we have in the museum aren't just for children and that you can get a lot out of it yourself. So just that communication goal, I think, is really important. But then also thinking about what is it that young adults, adults with their kids, adults without their kids, adults who have had their kids grow up and are now out of the house, what kind of service could we be doing for them? It's really about diversifying our audience. I think one of the things that I was introduced to when I first started working here was that Vermont and New Hampshire, and we do equally serve both states, has disappearing populations of young children. And we see that, I think, with school consolidations, with all of this happening. So this is a big story, right? Like, where are all the kids going? And they're going to stay here. People are going to move to Vermont. They're going to come. They're going to have kids. People are going to keep having kids. It happens. But just not as many kids as what fuels, I think, a youth-centric economy. So how do we diversify that audience? You know, we have Dartmouth College about a mile away from us with a lot of adults, I think 8,000 employees, you know, and they all are adults who want to be curious about things, and we want them to be curious about things, and this is a safe space for them to come in and just think. We're standing right in front of another amazing exhibit, which is our ant exhibition. It's this giant ant home sort of complex, and I find that, like, if I'm having a bad day, you come out and you sort of, like, look at the ants and you see what they're all doing and you start to find patterns and you start to see that they're just sort of going on about their business. And it just sort of snaps you out of whatever funk you were in and you start to say, okay, I think I'm seeing some kind of pattern here. I can take what I'm seeing from the ants, from what I'm experiencing and seeing this poor little ants, you know, carry giant leaves and creating food in a giant fungus garden. I can see some kind of connection to my work that I have to sort of go and do. And think all
a Sisyphean task that never ends.
Well, you know, I mean, work is work, right? So sometimes you got to keep writing reports. I think that seeing a giant ant colony isn't your everyday experience. You don't have that in your office. And I'm very lucky that I have it right outside of my office. But I think that when you sort of get unstuck, and I think that's what a lot of our exhibitions do for adults here, is that they sort of unstick them and they go, oh, wait a second. I can build this. I can. I'm seeing these ants in a different way, and maybe I'm seeing a pattern that I could help to manifest in some work that I'm doing. I think that's a very special thing, and that people just don't realize it, and they just need to sort of open themselves up to being in this kind of an environment to satisfy maybe the curiosity that they've sort of put under the bushel. Is that a right term? Like, do you hide a candle?
Sure.
You hide a candle under a bushel, right? So you hide a light under a bushel. So.
Saying. So I'll take it. I got it. It sounds like, though, you know, part of that is outreach and education and the museum's mission, but it sounds also like what you're saying is it's future sustainability for the museum, that you may not feel like you can sustain yourself just on the school-aged population into the future.
Right. I think, you know, as we're, we're turning 40 this year. When you turn 40 or you approach 40, you start realizing, like, oh, I might have more responsibility to this community than just me living and taking from its resources. And so for us, we've always been community-based, community-founded, but really starting to think about, all right, so here we are. What is it that we need to do to serve multiple audiences?
You know, it's interesting, I imagine, for you coming from, most immediately, from Brooklyn, and with at least one of your degrees in urban museum education, this must feel like a very, well, I wonder, does it feel like a different experience? In addition to the museum building, you have more than 100 acres that include trails and exhibits and wildlife. So how do you think about that coming from urban education in Brooklyn?
You know, it's a challenge because everything here is really new to me. So when I see the Connecticut River, I'm like, my gosh, that's the most amazing river that I've ever seen. I work on a river and trees and hiking. You know, I'm from Florida. So I grew up in a rural environment that was so hot that you never went outside, and on top of that there are numerous deadly snakes everywhere, so you are not really encouraged to go out hiking. So this summer I was just like mystified about like what people hike, and you can go hiking and this is a thing people do, and you go out and like the world is so beautiful, and we have 3 miles of trails. So to me the natural environment is like this super new thing that like, oh, you know, people, let's get people engaged with it, because in an urban environment you're constantly introducing people to the natural world. So most recently I worked in Brooklyn, and we had this little tiny park right outside of where the museum was, and that I for a fact know was most of the kids that we worked with only experience with nature. And we had a small urban garden, a small urban greenhouse where kids would, you know, feel plants, touch them, and it was like this new thing for them. They would hate the feel of the greenhouse because it was humid and they just didn't enjoy it. It smelled funny, like a plant. And that is not the case here. And that's something like, well, kids understand nature. So our job here is then to really help them sort of continue that love for nature and really think about their role in stewardship.
Let's walk down and see the exhibit, should be maybe wrapping up, where people are creating their own machines, and then it's sort of a Rube Goldberg experiment where you see if you can connect all the machines and get it to go around. And the museum has been doing this now for, 5 years, I think?
It's called Machine Madness, and it's really like, how do you move a ball in the most complicated way from point A to point B, and then how do you work with other tables and teams to connect your apparatus to another apparatus.
So here we are in the classroom, and you can see the family setting up, and this is a quieter environment. I feel like I should hush my voice because they look like they're very hard at work.
You know, you don't get to experiment with real materials a whole lot at home. We have cardboard boxes, we have hundreds of dowels, we have tons of wing nuts and screws and pegboard, and each table has a machine that a family has created, and the goal is to get them to all connect together so that a ball will go from one table to the ninth table and then do something pretty magnificent. The museum is that hub that brings them together and then mediates that experience for them. I think that's such a really special thing all around engineering, right? So like that's engineering, bringing people together.
Well, and that focus on engineering seems to be a relatively new focus of the museum, this sort of shift towards the makerspace movement and engineering and STEM fields. And so the Montshire is now, it's January 1st as we talk, so now is the 40th anniversary year, and you're planning a whole bunch of celebrations starting on January 10th. What do you think the future vision of the museum is in terms of priorities and education and getting people of all ages enthusiastic about what you're doing?
That's a large question. So the first part of that question, which is about making and STEM careers and what we call tinkering here, I think is getting people really to think about how the science that they're doing can relate to their everyday lives and also to fields and industry that they can become a part of. So the Connecticut River Valley for many years was called Industry Valley. Manufacturing was such a big part of what we did here. And it is actually still a big part of what we do. It's just more implicit and much more technical and much harder to do. So if you're going to work with a laser cutter, you're going to need an engineering degree to be able to help you figure that out, or you're going to need specialized classes, and you're going to need sort of the interest level to get you to do that and the grit to get you through those types of classes or coursework. So I think a lot of the work that we're doing with our school-based audiences or family-based audiences in engineering is really helping them to develop what we call grit in the field, right? So just staying with something long enough to figure it out and work with it, and then using an iterative process, which is what a museum is great for. Like, we can just keep doing things over and over and over again. The museum provides the materials. We have the environment to do that. That's he doesn't want to go, but the museum works really hard on helping people to achieve that that understanding that they need to work towards something, they need to keep at something. That's science, right? That's, you know, we have to keep questioning, we have to keep discovering, we have to keep collecting data. So producing citizens that feel that way, I think, is a really important thing that the museum is a vital resource towards. This year, one of the big exhibition experiences that we're going to offer is something called the Tinkering Loft, where kids will be able to experiment, and adults and teens and people of all ages will be able to experience making things with real materials, real tools, to get them excited about how their world operates from an industrial point of view, right? But once you start having that engineering skill or that tinkering skill embedded in you and that grit, it helps with other things too. It then helps you to say, okay, I'm going to go out and look at trees, but let me really examine and think about how many different types of trees there are out there in this world. With what the museum is moving towards and moving to, we are at a moment where we're really examining what our role in the community is. I think we're an anchor in the community here. We're, you know, a major institution. We're a major institution for the country, too. Like, we've been a museum for 40 years. We've been doing this for a long time. So community in general is something that we're thinking very much about. So how are we a resource? How can we help people out there in the future? And we need to do a lot more listening in that regard. That's something I think that we're doing this whole year. We're actually taking some time out to do some listening sessions, some research, to really figure out what best value can we be to, how can we be the best asset for the community.
Well, Marcos, I'm going to stick around here and see if all of the machines can connect and make this work, but I appreciate you talking with me. Thanks for telling me about the museum's history and the 40th anniversary, and welcome. You're still in your first year technically, so welcome to Vermont, and thanks for talking with me.
That's right. It's my first winter. Everyone said that I wouldn't make any friends until I survived a winter, so let's see.
This is a pretty good winter to survive, I have to say, if you have to have a first one.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming down today.
Marcos Staffney is executive director of the Montshire Museum of Science in Norwich. We have a link to all of the museum's upcoming exhibits at vpr.net. Down the hall from where we produce Vermont Edition is our performance studio, where, among other things, VPR invites in great local bands to record sessions for our music video series Live from the Fort. We've had a lot of great bands in the series. Medela, Cat Wright and the Indomitable Soul Band, and Rough Francis, just to name a couple. Today we highlight the high-energy improvisation of the Addison County duo Solimonde. Russ Lawton is on drums and Ray Pachkowski plays the Hammond organ. Here they are with a track from their new album, Smashed World.
We're kind of neighbors. Russ lives over in Salisbury. I'm outside of Middlebury. And we've played together over the years with Trey Anastasio Band. We were just looking for something to do, and there was this venue kind of down the road over the mountain. They had a Hammond organ. Just started getting together there and just making stuff up.
Yeah, it turned into something. Slidebrook, people go, they play once a month, yeah. You know, and then, you know, we would go make these home recordings and it was like, yeah, you gotta check it out. It really sounds good. So, one gig led to another.
It's improvisational music, for sure. So, you never know, we never know what. Very organic kind of thing. I'll have ideas for some melodic concepts, and Russ will have a beat that he's been working on or that he likes. It'll be like, check this out, and goes from there. And then we start talking about it. Well, we need another section here. We need something. Maybe you could do this. Maybe I could do this. And but even after the song is written or recorded, it keeps changing.
I need to do it. I mean, even like when I was a kid, I was always up in my room playing my drums, and it was really a form of expression. There's been times I've lived in cities and I couldn't really play my drums every day, and it was really hard for me on the drum pad, just trying to keep it up. But I wake up, now I live out in the woods, and I wake up every day and just make some tea and hit the drums.
Thank you. Solar Monday show, I think if you come see us, you're going to want to move because of the way Russ plays, and it's their grooves. But within that, I think, is some really interesting head music as well.
Definitely for music fans, people that dig a little bit deeper, too.
That's Russ Lawton and Ray Pechkowski. Their band is Solomonde. We heard the song Take My Hand from their new album Smashed World. Go to VPR.net and click on Live from the Fort to explore more of their music and to watch the performances of other great Vermont bands. And that's Vermont Edition for today. This week, the Vermont Senate takes up an electronic privacy bill. It's a wide-ranging measure that aims to balance the rights of individuals against the needs of law enforcement. But is it striking the right balance? We'll discuss what the bill does and what its critics want changed tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Our directors are Mary Williams and Liam Connors. And our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.